Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network Weekly Lecture Series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Tonight's speaker is Whitehead member Bob Weinberg. He's a founding member of the Whitehead Institute and a pioneer in cancer research. My sources tell me that he discovered the first human oncogene, which means a gene that causes normal cells to turn into tumors. My understanding is that he's also discovered the first tumor-suppressing gene, so he's not a total bad guy. By studying some of the fundamental genetics of cell function, his research is helping us understanding things like cell death, like metastasis, and how cancer invades the human body. It's worth noting that only a couple of days ago, he won a very prestigious award, one of two recipients of the 2006 Landon American Association for Cancer Research Prize, and thus is to be congratulated. Tonight, surprisingly enough, he's going to be talking about cancer. But more specifically, he's going to talk about research into the role that stem cells play in this disease. And so with that as introduction, I'd like to introduce Bob.
Thank you, David, for that kind introduction. Are we all mic'd up properly? I'm here to talk tonight about the intersection between the large body of research that's been accumulated over the last several decades on the origins of cancer and how this interdigitates with the much more recent studies on stem cells and how they act in normal tissues and how they act in malignant tissues, because we now come to realize that stem cells have implications not only for how normal tissues exist, how they regenerate themselves, but also how cancers arise as well in the human body. And just by way of a little bit of review, I remind us that cancers, in this case in the context of the colon, are simply aberrant forms of normal tissues. They're not invaders from outside the body. Cancers arise. Here is, for example, the lining of the intestine. Here we see fully normal tissue. Here we see tissue which, at the microscopic level, in this actually very poor image, one can't tell, but this tissue is misbehaving here, and here we see this florid overgrowth of tissue, which is an adenocarcinoma of the colon, which is obviously a tumor with high-grade potential to become a high-grade malignancy. And again, I emphasize that the cells that are forming this tumor here derive from pre-existing normal cells that existed in, for example, the lining of the colon long before this tumor began. One important aspect to realize about many kinds of human cancers is the fact that they represent a chaotic jumble of cells. Here we see maybe 100 cells in what's called a rhabdomyosarcoma. We see occasional normal muscle cells here, but in general, all one can see here is extensive chaos. And one can contrast that even more vividly if one looks, for example, in the context of the retina. Here's the way the normal retina looks, just by way of arbitrary example. And there's actually six or seven distinct cell layers here, one after the other. And without getting into any great detail, you can see that there's enormous architectural precision and function in the normal retina. We kind of take it for granted, those of us who are sighted. And yet, if one of these cells begins to grow inappropriately, one has this chaotic jumble that one sees here. This is called a retinoblastoma. Which has been studied for many years because of its interesting genetics. And this only goes to illustrate the fact that if one really wants to understand how a tumor is formed, one has to go back to the normal cells and ask how they've evolved progressively from being normal cells to be going to spawning this jumble of chaotic cells that we call a tumor. To put it another way, we know that the cells that exist within a normal tissue exist in a condominium with many other cells, and they're collaborating to create normal tissue architecture and function. The cells in the tumor, in contrast, are really interested in only one thing, which is to make more copies of themselves. So no longer are they part of this social compact that constitutes a normal tissue. Instead, these cells are only motivated with the single agenda item, that is runaway proliferation. Here's an even more chaotic tumor. The one I showed you before actually had a little bit of structure here. You see these little rosettes. But the most high-grade tumors are so chaotic and are such a jumble that a pathologist whose business it is to look under a microscope and to determine where such a tumor comes from looks at this and can't really tell. This tumor is called highly anaplastic, which is to say it has none of the marks, none of the hallmarks of one tissue or another, in contrast to the tumors I showed you before, which might provide some clue by virtue of the shape of the cells. So there's different gradations of tumors. This is a highly evolved tumor, and how it gets that way we'll speculate on very shortly. One other aspect of tumor biology that we should confront, if only briefly, is how the tumor actually arises. And let's imagine here are tumor masses. Here's one down here. Here's a tumor mass up here. And if we accept for a moment the fact that tumor cells come from normal cells, something that's been known for far longer than a century, we could at least tentatively embrace two alternative schemes to how cancers arise. One scheme says that a tumor mass is composed of a mixture of different cell populations. And if we trace each of these cell populations back, we see that here was a normal population of cells in a normal tissue. And we see in this particular diagram that four distinct cells having four different colors independently crossed over the boundary from being normal to being malignant, and then each of these cells spawned subpopulations within the tumor, four distinct different populations. The alternative view here is the following, that here we have a normal tissue, and one of these cells crosses over the boundary and becomes the progenitor, the ancestor of all the cells that constitute a tumor mass. And by the way, when I say a tumor mass, I remind us that a tumor mass, a centimeter by a centimeter by a centimeter, already has a billion cells in it, 10 to the ninth cells. Now, it turns, if we look at these two alternatives, we begin to realize that these are two very different ways by which tumors can arise. And the fact is, it's now been known for the last couple decades that virtually all tumors one looks at are of monoclonal origin. That is to say, if one has a tumor a centimeter in width, all of the cells in that tumor derive from a single progenitor that crossed over the boundary from normalcy to malignancy and then spawned this enormous cohort of descendants, which is to say the tumor mass. And this begins to focus our attention on this ancestral cell and ask ourselves the question, what caused this single cell to move over the boundary, to behave like a renegade cell, as it were, and to begin to multiply uncontrollably to create this large mass of descendant cells that is a human malignancy? One way of proving, by the way, the monoclonality of the tumor, that is to say, one way of proving the fact that all the cells in the tumor descend from a common progenitor, is to look at its chromosomes. This is just one of several ways of doing it. And one way of doing that is to imagine the following scenario. Let's say we have a normal tissue, and in one of these cells, these are the chromosomes in a series of previously normal cells. In one of these cells, a very strange and odd and randomly occurring alteration happens to the structure of the chromosome, which one can observe under the microscope. One may, in certain patients, then observe that all of the cells in a tumor that this patient may develop have this same very unusual, idiosyncratic change in their chromosomes, as is indicated here. And the fact that the formation of such a chromosome is a very rare and unpredictable event, and the fact that all the cells in the tumor have the identical kind of chromosomal abnormality already begins to provide us proof that all the cells in this tumor descend from this single progenitor in whom this chromosomal alteration took place, in whom this accident happened. And as a consequence, we're reinforced in our conviction that all the cells in the tumor descend from a single ancestral cell that began to launch this program of unrestrained proliferation. Another important aspect to assimilate if one is trying to understand how cancers arise is the fact that cancer is largely a disease of the old. And so the older we get, the greater the chance of tumors arising in the body. And here I'm just giving you, for both men and women, some of the epidemiology of cancer. And you can see from that that even though there are pediatric cancers, to be sure, and even though there are cancers that affect people in the early decades of their lives, in very large part, the incidence of most kinds of cancers increases rapidly as one gets older and older. This, of course, has implications, by the way, for the number of cancers that we will begin to register in our population as it gets, on average, older and older. It's not that a given individual at the age of 60 has a greater risk of getting cancer necessarily than he or she might have had 20 or 30 years ago, but there are many more people who are reaching the age of 60 and reaching the age of 70 and 80, and therefore cancer will become more prevalent simply because many of us will live through midlife and will no longer be struck down by diseases such as infectious disease and circulatory diseases that would have precluded our reaching the age of 70 or 80, where cancer becomes much more common. And here we can see now that these diseases take a very long time to develop, and that ultimately is the point of my showing you these graphs. Because if one looks at these graphs, one begins to conclude that it takes a very long time for most kinds of cancers to develop. In general, one imagines that it takes 3, 4, 5, 6 decades for most kinds of cancers to develop. Of course, there are exceptions to that, notably the pediatric cancers, but that's the general rule, and that means that the development of a cancer must go through a series of steps. One imagines 4, 5, 6 steps, each of which may take 10 or 15 years, and thankfully most of which will not reach completion by the time we reach the age of 90 or 95 or 100. And if one looks into, for example, once again the colon, one can begin to appreciate how this progressive evolution from a normal tissue to a malignant tissue happens. Because if one looks under the microscope, one can see a whole series of different levels of abnormality in the lining of the colon. Here is a normal lining of the colon as visualized by an artist, which, as is often the case, has almost no correspondence with the way things look in real life, but we'll leave that. Here is a hyperplastic growth. These are relatively normal cells growing up here, but there's just too many of them. These cells look pretty normal. They're behaving properly. These cells over here are slightly more advanced, slightly more abnormal. These cells are not only present in excessive numbers, but the shape of the cells and the size of their nuclei and their disposition with respect to one another is abnormal. Here we have a localized cancer. It's called an in situ cancer, and it may not yet have become invasive and distributed itself throughout the body. And here we have the most advanced kind of cancer, where the cancer cells have not only started to invade locally, but have begun, as you can see here where these in this blue illustration, have begun to deposit cells in the circulation. And such cells, once in the circulation, can then seed themselves, can disseminate to distant parts of the body where they form metastases, a theme I'll return to later. An even more advanced kind of cancer is one I showed you briefly and in passing before, an anaplastic cancer, whose cells are so advanced that they no longer bear any resemblance at all to the normal cells here in the lining of the colon. Now, having said that, one can actually put these in a whole progression, and one can make the assumption, one can draw up the model, that this progression, as one sees it here, from normal to highly aggressive cancer, seen here once again under the microscope, this being a more realistic depiction of what actually happens, represents what happens in real life in, for example, the human colon, where these cells change into these cells, change into these cells, and so forth. And one can imagine that each of these steps may take 5 or 10 years. One imagines, for example, in the case of colon cancer, that the more often you go to Wendy's or Burger King, the shorter the interval is between these various steps, and the more of a vegetarian you are, the longer the interval is between these steps, so that even though you might have reached the age of 90 as a vegetarian, some of these steps may have occurred, but not all of them will have occurred. But in any case, again, I emphasize that the intervals between each of these steps occurring is on the order of many years, 5, 10, 15 years, and therefore, obviously, most of us will reach a rather old age without the entire process having reached completion. In fact, the colon is only one example of a whole series of different tissues that one has studied over the last decades, in which there is this multi-step progression from a normal tissue into one that's highly malignant. And here I'm just showing you a whole series of these, as is indicated, a whole variety of different kinds of tumors. These happen all to be epithelial tissues, carcinomas. And when I say an epithelial tissue, I mean a layer of cells that's covering a body cavity or covering the skin or forming ducts in the breast or the air pouches in the lungs in the case of lung cancer. And here you see the time scale on which these things occur. Obviously, in the case of lung cancer, for example, the less one smokes, the longer the interval between these various stages. The more one smokes, the greater the acceleration of this. And so this is a generalizable model, this multi-step progression. It's not just true for colon cancer. It seems to be true for virtually all tissues in the body, depending on diet and lifestyle and hereditary predisposition, an issue we will not touch on today. Yet another input into our thinking comes from studies that were conducted at Johns Hopkins starting more than 15 years ago, in which these various kinds of normal and increasingly abnormal growths were studied at the genetic level. And what one learned was that the more advanced the cells have gone down this pathway, the more or the larger the number of genetic abnormalities they have accumulated. In other words, cells that go only the first step may have accumulated the loss of this particular gene. It's called APC. And therefore, cells that have become hyperproliferative, almost all of them, have lost this particular gene. And by the way, by having lost this gene, they lose a gene which normally functions to suppress their proliferation. So these cells which lose this growth-suppressing gene, this brake lining, begin to proliferate uncontrollably. Later on, there'll be another change, the activation of one of these evil oncogenes, as David Rapkin said before. And that will propel cells into the next stage of tumor progression. They'll lose another gene later on. This will propel them further on, and yet another one further on. And therefore, we begin to appreciate the possibility that this progression happens as cells accumulate an increasing number of genetic abnormalities in their genomes. In other words, cells down here might have one abnormal gene, but the cells that have moved all the way down here have already accumulated four distinct aberrant mutated genes. And the more mutated genes they have, the more poorly, the more abnormally they behave. In fact, one has actually been able to assign these genes to a series of regulatory subcircuits that operate in the cell and are responsible for governing various aspects of normal cellular behavior. So, for example, we now know that if you want to convert a normal cell, a normal human cell, into a cancer cell, there's at least five regulatory subcircuits operating inside the cell that must be perturbed, that must be disrupted, deregulated, in order for the cell to grow really as a cancer cell. And you have to change progressively this circuit, which normally damps down cell proliferation and serves as a brake lining. That has to be disabled. One has to disable this circuit. This is a cell suicide circuit. And normally, abnormally behaving cells in the body are discarded, are eliminated, because their internal suicide circuit is activated and these cells blow themselves up. A cancer cell needs to avoid that, and therefore it shuts down its internal suicide circuitry. This circuit here allows a cell to grow only when it has adequate nutrients. And cancer cells like to grow even when there aren't adequate nutrients around. So that connection is also disabled. This circuit here is involved in determining how many successive cell divisions a population of cells can go through. Can it divide 10 times in succession, 50 times, or 100 times? Most normal cells have only a limited ability to replicate, to go through a succession of growth and division. And by disabling this circuit, a cell is able to grow an unlimited number of times, and thus cancers are able to grow to a very large size because the circuitry that normally circumscribes and limits the proliferative potential of cells is disabled. And this circuit over here provides a continuous growth stimulus to the cancer cell. In other words, this circuit here acts as if it were a stuck accelerator pedal on the floor of a car, pushing a cell to growing inexorably. This circuit over here represents a defective brake lining. This circuit over here represents a self-replenishing tank of gas. And when the cell has acquired all of these different deregulations, it can now grow as a cancer cell. In other words, there's great redundancy, and just knocking out one circuit in a cell or this one will not suffice to create a cancer cell. And this begins to explain why the process of creating a cancer is so complex. Our cells have been evolved over the last 100 million years to be very resistant to becoming converted into cancer cells. And the way this resistance is manifested by the fact that there are multiple redundant circuits, all of which must be disabled in order for the normal cell to grow as a fully malignant cell. And we imagine this now. When I say we, I mean those people who think about this on a daily basis, as a series of regulatory subcircuits in a cell. Here it's depicted very schematically, but you can almost begin to think of these regulatory circuits much like a wiring board in a solid-state electronic apparatus. In fact, each of these circles here represents one or another protein that it's intercommunicating with another protein inside the cell. And here's one circuit inside the cell that is responsible for determining whether a cell lives or whether it kills itself, the suicide circuit I told you about before. This circuit over here, the pink one, is involved in providing a proliferative stimulus to the cell. This circuit over here is the brake lining of the cell that I mentioned before. This circuit over here, in the case of cancer, determines whether or not a cell is able to move and invade into distant tissues. And we believe, all in all, there could be as many as 1,000 proteins that intercommunicate within a cell, much the way resistors and capacitors and transformers and induction coils talk with one another inside individual cells. But in this case, the intercommunicating components are not silicone diodes and so forth. They're actual proteins that talk to one another and exchange signals in different ways. Again, I emphasize the fact that we now appreciate that at least 5 of these subcircuits need to be disrupted before a cell will grow as a cancer cell, and each of these disruptions takes a very long time. And this begins to bring us ever more closely to Darwinian evolution. Here's a picture of Darwin as a young man, and when his nose grew a bit longer and his beard a lot longer, as an old man. And Darwin's thinking has permeated our preconceptions, our intellectual models about how cancer arises. And now we increasingly think of multi-step cancer progression, as I've described it, as Darwinian evolution occurring in the microcosm of a human tissue. And the thinking, for what it's worth, is like this. Here we have a population of normal cells up here, fully normal cells, and in one of those cells there is an initiating mutation, a single mutation which somehow deregulates one or another of the subcircuits I referred to before. And a cell which has sustained this mutation now has more proliferative advantage than all the other cells nearby. And therefore, this cell starts growing much better than all the other cells around it because it has this very advantageous mutation. And soon, I say maybe over a period of 5 or 10 years, it might have 1 million descendants which have overgrown in the localized area where they first arose. Now you see all these red cells down here. Obviously, I can't draw 1 million of them. But now there are 1 million of these descendants which have done much better than all the cells that lack this mutation. And after this happened, in one of those 1 million descendants, another mutation occurs, once again randomly, and maybe these mutations occur, on average, 1 per 1 million cells. And if they occur only that frequently, or if they occur that rarely, you need about 1 million of these descendants before it becomes even possible for a second mutation to have struck the genome of this cell to create now a doubly mutated cell. And now this red and green cell, doubly mutated, has even more growth advantage than all the non-mutated cells, the normal cells, or even the singly mutated cells that are just red. And now the red and green cells proliferate even more rapidly, and after a period of 5 or 10 years, one of their descendants sustains yet another mutation, which confers even greater growth advantage, proliferative advantage in the context, and now it begins to spawn a whole new population. And this is a model which is taken directly out of Darwin's Origin of the Species. Of course, Darwin didn't really know about mutations the way we know now. It's called the modern synthesis of Darwinian evolution. Now we realize that the reason why species are able to have advantage over other species, or one population has more advantage than another population within a species, is that the individuals who have more advantage have a better set of genes, and that they've acquired these new or better genes because of mutations like this. Of course, here we're not talking about evolution of species, we're talking about evolution of cells. But the same kinds of dynamics are played out in the context of a tissue as are played out in the wild during the evolution of species. And so if we want to map these two kinds of discussions with one another, we can imagine that each of these mutations here affects a different one of these regulatory circuits. And after this, the first mutation disrupts this circuit over here, giving a certain degree of proliferative advantage. Subsequently, the second mutation affects this circuit here, and the third mutation affects this circuit. And the more regulatory subcircuits that are disrupted within a cell, the more rapidly the cell will grow until ultimately it will assume all of the attributes of a cancer cell. Now, this has some interesting conceptual implications because it implies that all the cells in a population of cancer cells that have the same number of mutations are equally suited to become the ancestors of the next generation, the next population. So let me elaborate on that for a moment. Here we have one of these subpopulations of cells which is growing exponentially. When I say exponentially, I mean 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, whatever. Every time the cells go through a cycle of growth and division, the population doubles. And what we imagine is here is a cell which, let's say, had three mutations, and all of its descendants also have three mutations. There's not yet been an additional mutation that's occurred to them. And if we were to pluck cells out of any part of this mass, this subpopulation, each of them would be equally qualified to generate a new tumor if we plucked that cell out of this population, and we put it into, for example, a small mouse, in which the mouse would be receptive to the growth of a human tumor cell. Such mice are, by the way, special breeds of mice whose immune systems are hospitable to the growth of implanted human cancer cells. And so this cell could grow to form a tumor, this cell could form a tumor, this cell, and this cell. And therefore, all the cells in this subpopulation, they're not only genetically equal, but they're equally well qualified to generate a new tumor. That's implicit in this Darwinian model. And what I'm going to raise now is the question of whether it's really true. Are some cells more equal than others? Are all the cells in such a genetically identical subpopulation biologically equivalent? Are they equally qualified to generate a new tumor? Or are there complications to this scheme? And in fact, this is the scheme right here. Here we presume that all the cells in this population, in this subpopulation, are equally well qualified to generate a new successor population, whether the mutation happens here or here or here or anywhere else in this population of a million cells. All of the cells in this subpopulation, all the cells with this one red sector, could equally well sustain a green mutation, allowing them to become doubly mutated cells. But the alternative to this is that only one of the cells in this subpopulation is actually qualified to become the ancestor to the successor population. And the other ones, conversely, don't have those qualifications. These other ones, even though they may be genetically identical to the more qualified cell up here, these other ones cannot become ancestors to the other population for reasons that I'll get into in a minute. So we begin to have to think about revisions of this Darwinian model, and we think about this by virtue of the discovery of stem cells. After all, that is why you came here tonight, not only cancer, but stem cells. So I didn't want to bring you here under false pretenses. So what do we mean by a stem cell? Well, many of you know what a stem cell is. Maybe some of you don't. So I just want to go into a little bit of it, in a little bit of background. A stem cell, for one thing, is a cell which is able to self-renew. And when I say self-renew, when that cell divides, as you see here, I think we've just lost Worcester. I hope the city's still there. Anyhow, when this cell divides, it has two daughter cells. Obviously, one cell divides in two. It has two daughter cells. And note here that one of the daughter cells remains blue and the other cell becomes red. And this is called asymmetric division. But the important thing is after the division has occurred, we still have one blue cell. We had one blue cell before. We have one blue cell afterwards. We can note this like this, or another way of noting this, another graphic convention noting this, is right here, where this cell divides, but now the arrow goes back reflexively to indicate the fact that as a consequence of the cell division, we still have one blue cell, and we now have one red cell. So these are just two ways of drawing the same process. And if we adhere, for example, to the second graphic convention, we can now begin to expand this theme a little bit. Let's imagine we have a tissue here, and let's imagine that this blue cell is a stem cell, and it's self-renewing. And again, when I say self-renewing, I mean that when the cell divides, one of its two daughters will be just like mom, and therefore there will be no net gain or loss of these stem cells. And down here within a tissue, we have what are called highly differentiated cells. I'll get into them in a minute. But one of the things I want to emphasize at this point is that when this cell divides, one of its two daughters changes its biological makeup and becomes the ancestor of all the cells down here, rather than remaining like mom. So we now begin to understand that when a stem cell divides here, or here, or here, one of the two daughters stays a stem cell, and the other daughter begins to spawn a whole cohort of progeny that are very different from the stem cell that we began out, that we began with. And we can depict this actually in a slightly different way. It's almost the same. It's a little more elaborate model, and it's nicer because it's got more colors. Anyhow, here's a lineage of stem cells. Here's one stem cell. It divides. One of the daughters becomes green. The other daughter remains blue. This stem cell divides. One of its daughters remains blue. The other daughter becomes green. This stem cell divides, one of its daughters becomes blue, the other daughter becomes green. Note, as I said before, that the population of stem cells is unchanged by all this. And we call this the stem cell compartment, not necessarily because it represents a physical compartmentalization, it just represents a way of categorizing these cells. So we have a self-renewing population of stem cells here, and let's for a moment focus on the other daughter. The daughter, which it becomes green, and in many kinds of tissue, these green cells begin to multiply exponentially for a period of time. When I say exponentially for a period of time, I mean maybe going through 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 doublings, but not 4,000 doublings, a finite number of doublings, and after a very circumscribed number of doublings, these cells, which have been dividing frenetically, then begin to generate the red cells as their ultimate progeny. And these red cells are highly differentiated. And when I say a highly differentiated cell, I mean to suggest that these cells become highly specialized to carry out the predesigned task of the tissue in which they reside. So these cells are actually doing the work of the tissue. These cells here are multiplying madly to create all the red cells. And these cells here have a relatively short life because they divide frenetically, and then after 4, 5, 6 doublings, they enter into a state which we call, in the trade, post-mitotic. That is to say, these red cells will never grow again. But while they're alive, they do the work of the tissue. Now, this actually has some great advantages to it, this scheme, because we can imagine that the master organizers of the tissue are the stem cells. And we could also imagine that we want the stem cells in a tissue to divide as infrequently as possible. Why? Because every time a cell divides, there's a danger that something bad is going to happen. That, for example, genes could be damaged or the DNA could be miscopied. And therefore, in this scheme here, this cell only divides every once in a while, and each time it divides, one of its daughters, the green one here, spawns maybe 100 progeny. from this green cell may have ultimately 100 progeny. And so in order to generate many of these specialized differentiated cells, the tissue is organized so that the master cells up here only need to divide every week or two. Whereas all these cells are growing frenetically and ending up with the red cells here. But I will tell you, to anticipate something I'm going to tell you momentarily, these cells are sooner or later going to be swept away and gotten rid of. And if anything bad happens during their frenetic cycles of growth and division, it's okay, because we're going to get rid of these cells sooner or later because they have a relatively short lifetime. Whereas the lineage of stem cells in a tissue goes on, in principle, forever. These cells are disposable. These cells in the stem cell compartment are indisposable. We need to keep them around. And they have an unlimited ability to self-renew. This lineage can go on and on and on forever. The green cells here, the transient amplifying cells, I told you, they can go for 4, 5, 6 divisions, but then they stop. They're programmed to stop and generate these highly differentiated cells here. And what this has to do with cancer will become apparent in a moment. Again, I want to just introduce into our vocabulary, by the way, the notion of asymmetric versus symmetric division. When a stem cell divides, we say that division is asymmetric because its two daughters are different one from the other. When one of these transient amplifying cell divides, we call it a symmetric division because the two daughters are identical to one another. If we hadn't thought about stem cells, we would assume that all cell divisions are symmetric. But the discovery of stem cells causes us to realize that many cells in the body are organized so that the two daughters assume different roles. One like mom, and the other takes on a new kind of role, a new task in the body. So just to refer back again to our scheme, this is an asymmetric division right here, stem cell giving two different kinds of daughters, and these transient amplifying cells here have symmetric divisions until they reach down here, and then these cells will never divide again. They become highly differentiated. When they go from green to red, they take on many of the attributes that are required in order for these cells to maintain the architecture of the tissue and to do the daily work of the tissue. And this conversion from the green to the red state doesn't involve an additional cell division. It just involves a change in the behavior of the cell without any additional cell division. And let's give this some real-life reality. Not a great sentence, but you know what I'm talking about. You sense. Here is a well-studied biological system, a tissue. This happens to be the small intestine. And in the small intestine, one has these very deep cavities in the wall of the small intestine. These are called crypts. And in the crypts, way at the bottom of these crypts are stem cells. And when one of these stem cells divides, it generates a whole population of transient amplifying cells of the sort that I talked about before that divide exponentially, albeit for a limited number of successive cell divisions. And then what happens is, here we have the highly differentiated cells, these blue cells up here. And these blue cells are continuously migrating up this long finger, it's called a villus, up to the tip of the villus. And then, like going off the end of a gangplank, they're discarded, they move up here, and they die. And in fact, we all had supper, but a significant proportion of the solid matter of your stool comes from the remains of these stem cells, of these blue cells here, not the stem cells, which have been shed into the intestine. Every day we shed maybe hundreds of billions of these cells into our intestine, and the lifetime from the cells going from here up to here may only be 3 or 4 days. These cells, the stem cell divide once, and ultimately the stem cell, the division from one stem cell can yield as many as 3,500 descendant cells, which migrate progressively up, continuously up the tip to the villus, and then they're thrown away. Why do we get rid of all these cells all the time? Because when they're sticking this finger out into the cavity of the small intestine, these cells are exposed to everything we eat every day. And lots of things that we eat every day are not good for cells. Some of them may be mutagenic. And besides that, there are at least 100, if not 500, different species of bacteria in your colon. They're not so nice either. And there's all the metabolites, the breakdown products of your food. So these cells really have to put up with a lot of abuse. And therefore, they're in high danger of becoming damaged and becoming mutated. But we don't care, because even if these cells become mutated, we're going to get rid of them anyhow. Because after 3 or 4 or 5 days, they're discarded. They're thrown away. Who stays behind? Ultimately, the only cells that stay behind are the stem cells. They're always there. They're always cranking out descendants. But look at the way they are. They're kept out of the way. In fact, if you look at the bottom of one of these crypts, this purple here represents mucus. There are cells in here which secrete a lot of mucus, so that there's a big mucus plug up the center of this. What is it there for? It prevents all the nasty stuff that's in the colon or the duodenum from getting down and damaging the stem cells. So these stem cells are highly protected physically, and also they don't divide that often. Every once in a while, they divide and they say, I need to make another 3,500 descendants. And so they start sending all these cells up here. It's a very clever scheme, and it actually works very well. The probability that one of these cells will become a cancer cell, it turns out, is extraordinarily low. And if you don't go to Wendy's or McDonald's, it's almost zero. There are places in the world where people just don't get colon cancer. And it's clearly colon cancer is clearly a dietary problem. Okay, and I just want to give another example of this stem cell organization, because it's not just in the colon, it's in every tissue of the body. In certain tissues, there's a continuous self-renewal. Another tissue, which is very rapidly self-renewing all the time, are the hematopoietic cells. That is, the cells that form the blood, the cells in the blood, the red and white cells in the blood, as well as the cells of the immune system. And here we have a stem cell, just to make sure you're getting your money's worth in terms of a stem cell lecture. And there's a single cell we know that's sitting in the bone marrow that's capable of giving this cell, and this cell can give two daughters, which have begun to commit themselves to being two different kinds of cell types. This is a myeloid cell type, and this is a lymphoid cell type. These make lymphocytes. These make a variety of other cells. And here we see that each of its descendants can go down a different lineage to assume different end-stage post-mitotic differentiated traits. These cells here in this last row, or this last column, are very different from one another in terms of the biological jobs that they undertake. They're very different. But what has happened is that the stem cell is able to produce these progeny, which then can make decisions as to whether they're going to make one of these daughters, one of these daughters, one of these daughters, and one of these daughters. And depending on what's needed on any one day and on any 1 hour in your body, different proportions of these descendant cells will be formed. Again, you see these self-renewing stem cells here. And we know that you can replenish the entire hematopoietic system with a single cell if you do the experiment properly. One cell can not only generate thousands of descendants, but these descendants can decide to undertake different kinds of end-stage fates, depending on the environment they happen to find themselves in. So again, I'm showing you this if only to indicate that this hierarchical relationship between the different cells obtains not just in the colon, but in many tissues throughout the body. And these are, by the way, adult stem cells, not embryonic stem cells, cells that are ensconced in adult tissues and are dividing throughout our adult lifetimes. There's many organisms, by the way, that don't have such stem cells that are continuously growing and dividing. For example, flies. When a fly comes into the world, almost all its tissues that existed when it was born stay with it without undergoing continuous replication. But in many of our tissues, they're continually renewing themselves because the differentiated cells get worn out or become damaged, which justifies this kind of organization. Now, I want to introduce you, albeit very briefly, to a technique. And the technique, it's called fluorescence-activated cell sorting, and we don't need to understand in detail how it works. I just want to emphasize the fact that if we have a population of cells here which has different markers on its surface, we can separate a heterogeneous population of cells, red cells, pink cells, gray cells, from one another in a, what's called a fluorescent activated cell sorter. We can physically separate a whole population of cells. So if you pass a million cells through a cell sorter, the cell sorter will put the gray cells in one test tube, the red cells in another test tube, the pink cells in yet another test tube. It's a very elegant technique. And this separation depends on the proteins which happen to be displayed on the surface of the cells in this population. And again, we can assume for a moment that these cells, their redness comes from the fact they're expressing one kind of protein or antigen on their surface, their grayness another on their surface, their pinkness another kind of antigen on their surface. And this technique allows this heterogeneous population of cells to be fractionated, to be separated one from another physically. And with this kind of procedure, one has done a very interesting experiment. This was done in Michigan about 3 years ago in Ann Arbor. Somebody took a population of human breast cancer cells and separated them from one another on the basis of this analysis that I showed you in the last slide. And the fact is they separated these on the basis of their ability to express two cell surface proteins. One's called CD24, the other's called CD44. And cells that express a lot of CD24 go up on this scale. Cells that express a lot of CD44 go up on this scale. And for reasons that really are not worthy of our attentions tonight, they separated the populations out into two subpopulations. They took a whole mess of breast cancer cells and they fractionated them into two subpopulations. The population of cells here, which had high CD4 expression, but had low CD24 expression. And here in this green square, we see this population of cells. Cancer cells, which out under the microscope, they all look identical. These cells, which look identical under the microscope, have a different set of antigens on their surface, and they express high CD24 expression and high CD44 expression. And independent of what those two names mean, the fact is that this allowed them to put one set of cancer cells in one test tube and another set of cancer cells, breast cancer cells, in the other test tube, even though under the microscope these two populations of cells were indistinguishable one from the other. And then they did a very interesting experiment. This may not be the most interesting thing you heard today, but it's kind of interesting. They took these cells and they found that as few as 200 of these cells, when put into a mouse, would give that mouse a tumor. They did the same experiment with this and they found that they needed to put an enormous number of these cells into a mouse, and even then it did not form a tumor, even though these cells and these cells look identical to one another. Now, I will tell you, when I was growing up, which was a long time ago, in order to make a tumor in a mouse, generally you had to put 100,000 or even 1,000,000 cancer cells into a mouse to get a tumor. A lot. The process of seeding a tumor was extraordinarily inefficient. But look what they did here. 200 of these cells form a tumor. 20,000 of these fail to form a tumor, even though all these cells look identical one to the other. And that suggests the notion that these cells may be able to self-renew and to populate an entire tumor, and that these cells over here are unable to self-renew, are unable to multiply even any further, even though they were sitting in the tumor. And this begins to plant in our minds the notion that not all cancer cells are equal. Some are potent in becoming the ancestors of a whole new population of cancer cells. As few as 200 can do this. Others, 20,000 of them, an enormous number of these cells, they fail to do so. And so they, by necessity, must have a very limited replicative potential. They are unable to seed a new tumor population. And here, a similar experiment was done with cells from a brain cancer up in Toronto. They separated this population of brain cancer cells into cells that expressed other cell surface proteins, those that express little of CD133, whatever that is, and a subpopulation that expresses a lot of CD133, this being a surface antigen, a surface marker on the surface of these cells. Again, these cells all look the same. If they looked in this medulloblastoma, that's a cerebellar tumor, they saw a minority of cells, you see the red arrows here, that happened to express this protein. You see these red staining cells right here. Most of the cells in the tumor didn't express this protein. And they plucked out these cells here from this population, and these cells, this minority, were able to form clumps of tumor cells and to seed a population just like before. These cells over here, which had a little bit of CD133, 100,000 of these cells were unable to form a tumor. As few as 100 of these cells were able to form a tumor. Again, the same kind of dichotomy between cells that can see the tumor in very small numbers and those that cannot see the tumor in spite of very high numbers of these cells. And now we begin to think of the notion, which has really revolutionized cancer research over the last two or three years, that the cancer cells in the tumor are organized in a hierarchical relationship that mirrors the hierarchical relationship that operates in normal tissues. In other words, let's imagine these are all a population of cancer cells. These are all cells that have multiple mutations in them. These cells together constitute a tumor. If you look under the microscope at all these cells, they all look like cancer cells. But if you ask what the properties of these cells are, then you find if you take these blue cells out of the tumor, like I showed you before, a very small number of these cells, these blue cancer cells, will form a new tumor because these cells are able to grow and divide forever. But the great bulk of the cells in the tumor, which look the same under the microscope, are these cells over here. And even though they look like cancer cells, you place lots of these cells in a mouse, nothing happens. Great majority of cells in the cancer are therefore these non-stem cells, which have very limited replicative potential. A small minority of the cells in the cancer are organized like this. They can go on forever, and if you take them out of one tumor and you put them in a mouse, they'll generate a whole new tumor mass. So this really has revolutionized cancer biology because everybody used to think that all the cancer cells in a tumor were biologically identical to one another. And now we see that maybe they aren't at all. They're really, some are more equal than others. These are the ones that really keep the tumor growing. These just sit around and pretend they're cancer cells, but they don't really do very much because many of them have lost the ability to replicate anymore. This, by the way, has a very interesting implication to it if you're interested in Malthusian growth and the replication of tumor cell populations. Here is a population of exponentially growing cancer cells. And if you would have asked me some years ago, not so long ago, embarrassingly, how are the cells in a cancer organized, I'd say, well, they are organized like this. Every time they divide, you get two new cancer cells, and all the cells in the tumor are equal to one another. In other words, they're all capable of seeding a tumor, like the blue cells over here. And obviously, I'm arguing now, that's no longer our perception. But there's an interesting implication of this. Each time this population of cells doubles, each divides, you get a doubling of the population. This population of cells in this tumor has a quasi-linear growth. It grows rather slowly. It doesn't grow exponentially. And therefore, Darwinian selection says, given enough time, you gradually will evolve towards a state where all the cells in the tumor will start dividing symmetrically and generate daughter cells that will themselves be stem cells. And what this suggests is that even though most tumors start out like this, sooner or later, they will evolve to a state where all the cells in the tumor become stem cells. It happens, for better or worse, this doesn't often occur in human patients because these tumors succeed in killing the patient long before this inevitable progression has occurred. It's unpleasant, but that's the way life or death is. By the way, this population of cells might be highly anaplastic. It doesn't show any of the specialized traits of a tissue, unlike this tumor, because keep in mind that the bulk of the cells in the tumor mass here are these red cells, which still show many of the attributes, the idiosyncrasies, the traits of the normal tissue from which this cancer arose. So we're beginning to draw this very strong analogy. This is the way normal tissues are organized. This is the way a tumor is organized. It's a very similar kind of scheme. It's just that this mass of cells will keep on growing, whereas this mass of cells will grow to a certain size and then stop growing. As long as the normal tissue reaches a certain size, this process will be self-limiting, whereas these cells, for reasons that we don't totally understand, will continue to grow even when continued growth is inappropriate. And that raises the obvious question. How do we get from here over to here? How does a normal tissue evolve into this kind of a cancerous tissue? One way we can imagine is we take one of these normal stem cells and we give it all those mutations I've been talking about, and we convert it into a cancer stem cell. And that's the most parsimonious, that's the simplest way of doing it. Convert a normal stem cell into a cancer stem cell. And then you get this hierarchical relationship once again, but obviously in a tissue that continues to grow indefinitely. And so maybe these cells way at the bottom here are actually the origin. They must be mutated, they must be damaged in order to get a tumor stem cell to form. But there are other possibilities. We have to keep our minds open, although that's a very unnatural trait for scientists. Here's another possibility. Maybe the transit amplifying cells in a normal tissue become mutated and become converted into cancer stem cells. That's a possibility. Nobody really knows. We think in certain kinds of leukemias, it's these cells which become mutated into cancer stem cells. It's an issue that still needs to be resolved. At present, we don't really understand that. But still, the notion that there are cancer stem cells and that, that cells in the tumor are organized in this hierarchical relationship is increasingly embraced in the population of among cancer researchers. And as I often say, just because it's a model, just because it's a theory, doesn't mean it's wrong. On occasion, these things are actually correct. So here, this notion that all the cells in the tumor are equally qualified to be the progenitors of the next population is probably wrong. It may only be the cancer stem cells that can become the progenitors. And the way that a population of cancer cells evolves is stem cells in the first generation, mutated into stem cells in the second generation, mutated into stem cells in the third generation, and so forth. In other words, it's the stem cells that progressively evolve into a higher degree of malignancy. And obviously, each of these stem cell populations here spawns transit amplifying cells, and what is not shown in this diagram, the end-stage post-mitotic differentiated cells that constitute the bulk of the cells in a tumor. And therefore, this diagram is very different from the one I showed you before, and it has many implications whose ramifications we haven't even begun to plumb. So this is really a serious issue for reasons I mentioned before, and I just want to tell you why cancer research could be, for better or worse, a full employment act for biomedical researchers for a long time to come, just to emphasize the importance of working this out properly. Here is the population of people in this country over the age of 65 for the next decades. Here is the mortality over the last 5 or 6 decades, male or female mortality for males and females. It hasn't changed that much for cancer mortality. It would have gone down a lot more. People would have stopped smoking, but whatever. Here is the curves I showed you before, which indicate that cancer is a disease largely of old people. And if you accept this, and you accept this, you end up with these curves here. The number of cases of cancer in this country is going to increase more and more and more, not because any one of us is at greater risk of getting cancer than we were 50 years ago, but because there's so many more of us in terms of more people who were living to the age of 60 or 70 or 80 when this disease becomes common. So this indicates how critically important it is to understand what's going on here. And I want to give you some other implications, just to finish, of how the cancer stem cell theory affects our ways of treating and cancer. Here's one kind of common cancer where recent biomedical research at the molecular level has had a remarkable success. And I want to share it with you because cancer stem cells have an important a role to play in this story. The disease I'm talking about is chronic myelogenous leukemia. It's not so uncommon. And it's caused when two chromosomes fuse with one another. And the fused chromosome looks like this. It's called the Philadelphia chromosome after its site of discovery. And as a consequence of fusing the blue with the white chromosome, you end up fusing two genes with one another, BCR and ABL, they're called. And as a consequence of that, this fused gene makes a very long protein and an enzyme in here, which is called a kinase. And this kinase starts firing uncontrollably and pushing and pushing and pushing the growth of myelogenous cells, cells from the bone marrow. So this malfunctioning protein, it's a hybrid protein, operates to push inexorably the growth of cells in the bone marrow, which creates the leukemia. Now, a drug has been developed called Gleevec. And Gleevec, you see all these nasty purple cells in the marrow of a person who is suffering from chronic myelogenous leukemia. You treat them with Gleevec, and all that's left, these are red blood cells out here. These are normal red cells, so this is good. You see a couple normal cells, myeloid cells, which are the remnants of these nasty cancer cells. These cells are quite normal. In many kinds of CML, chronic myelogenous leukemia patients, treatment with Gleevec will reduce the population of cancer cells by 1,000, 10,000, even 100,000 fold. It's extraordinary. And what happens is, here's the drug I've told you about. It's made by Novartis. This is not an advertisement. Anyhow, and this drug nestles into the fusion protein. I told you about it before, the Abl kinase protein. Here's the way this drug sits in the pocket of this larger protein. This is a microscopic view of this much larger protein. Here you see the Gleevec molecule nestled into this much larger kinase. Here you see it blown up. This Gleevec molecule nestles into this kinase and shuts it down. And when it shuts it down, we get this dramatic effect on the clinical behavior. Lots of cancer cells, disappearance of cancer cells, and a relapse rate which may be as low as 5% per year. By that I mean patients, CML patients, who normally had a prognosis of living for 2 or 3 years may now live for 20 years, as far as we know. In other words, after the first year, 95% of them are still good. After the second year, 90% of them are still good. It's really an extraordinary step forward because of this new drug. What does Gleevec do? Gleevec gets rid of all the pink cells, the red, the transamplifying cells, and the end-stage differentiated cells. But look who stays behind. The cancer stem cells. They're very small in number, but they are not eliminated by Gleevec. What happens when you take away the Gleevec? The whole tumor springs back to life. Why? Because the regenerative capacity of the tumor has been untouched. It's the cancer stem cells. And so we begin to realize now that even though Gleevec is a miracle drug, it doesn't give one a cure. In order for a patient to survive, you have to continue to give the drug, which has minimal side effects, by the way, for an indefinite period of time. The moment you halt treatment, the stem cells, which are always hanging around, albeit in very small number, start growing again and regenerating the tumor. In fact, as far as we know, in most kinds of treatments of cancer, the stem cells are not damaged that much by most of the existing treatments of cancer, which may represent the explanation for why we have relatively low rates of cure for most kinds of solid human tumors. Why is it so hard to get rid of the stem cells? It's because of something I told you earlier. When you treat growing cells, cells that are rapidly growing, with a drug like Gleevec, it kills them. But cells that are non-growing or growing infrequently are relatively resistant to killing. These cells that are growing frenetically are very vulnerable to being killed by a drug. These cells that hardly divide at all, they just sit around there and they just let the Gleevec pass by them, but they're unaffected, and therefore they jump back to life if the Gleevec treatment is halted. So here's one other final implication of cancer stem cells, and that's the last stage of tumor progression indicated over here. I'm almost done, by the way, so you will get home tonight. So here is the last step, metastasis. Remember I said metastasis before was the spreading of cells from the primary tumor to distant sites in the body. Here's, for example, metastasis from a lymphoma. And all these yellow sites here are metastases starting from a primary tumor whose origin is not clear from here. This is the brain. That's fine. Don't worry about that. But here all these metastases are growing all over the place. And this is what metastatic disease looks like. Here's what a metastasis looks like right here. This is a breast cancer cell but made by a member of the audience here tonight, Dr. Inche. And here is a metastasis in the muscle. Once again, a new colony of cancer cells that has separated from the primary tumor and seeded itself at a distant site in the body. Here's yet another metastasis. Here's breast cancer cells that are growing inside a lymph node. Here are the breast cancer cells growing in this unfamiliar environment, the lymph node. Lymph node is out here. The breast cancer cells are right here. They've moved away from the primary tumor, the site in the breast, into a nearby lymph node. And now we can pose some other questions. Are all the cells in the primary, cancer cells in the primary tumor, equally qualified to generate a metastasis? Or are some more equal than others? So here's what metastasis looks like. It's actually quite complicated, but we don't have to spend a lot of time on the details. Cells in the primary tumor, they invade locally, they get into the circulation, they spread through the circulation. They get out of the circulation in some distant site, and they form a micrometastasis, a small cluster of cells somewhere at a distant place in the body. And then these cells in the micrometastasis, on rare occasion, will learn how to form a macroscopic metastasis, which becomes clinically apparent. 30% of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer have thousands of micrometastases throughout their body. But only half of those women will ever develop metastatic disease, because going from this step here up to this step is extremely inefficient. So as nasty as cancer is, thankfully, some of these steps just don't work very well. And the chance of a cancer cell going through all these and evolving to a macroscopic metastasis is very small, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000. Nobody really knows the number. Here's what some of these micrometastases look like in the bone marrow. Here you see one. Here you see another. One of these is a breast cancer. I think this is a colon cancer, which has seeded micrometastases in the bone marrow. And these may sit around for years. Here's more of a macroscopic metastasis, once again in the lymph nodes. And these micrometastases may be there by the hundreds, by the thousands in a breast cancer patient and never do anything. Or, on rare occasion, they may evolve into a macroscopic metastasis. Let's map this scheme into what we've just been talking about cancer stem cells. If the cells here in this micrometastasis have only a limited proliferative capacity, like the transit amplifying cells, the red cells in the tumor, then even though they've landed at this distant site, they could never multiply to form a macroscopic metastasis, because most of the cells in the primary tumor, even though they may have, are only endowed, as I've said repeatedly, with a limited replicative potential. The only cells in the tumor which have an unlimited replicative potential are the cancer stem cells. So therefore, we can imagine that if a cancer stem cell seeds to a distant part of the body, because it has unlimited replicative potential, it has no impediment. It could begin to evolve in this direction. But if one of the transit amplifying cells or one of the end-stage post-mitotic differentiated cells in the tumor seeds itself to a distant site in the body, even though it's gotten very far away, it's only allowed to multiply 4, 6, 8 times. I told you that before. And therefore, it has no chance of forming a macroscopic metastasis because its proliferative potential is highly circumscribed. And that may explain why most micrometastases can never form macroscopic metastases, because the cells in the micrometastasis are not endowed with enough successive replicative doublings to form a growth like this, which has millions and ultimately billions of cells in it. And so we have this notion in terms of metastasis. These cells that they disseminate may be well qualified to go from a micrometastasis to a macroscopic metastasis because these cells have unlimited proliferative capacity. But these cells over here, even though they may be disseminated from the primary tumor with equal likelihood, they may end up in distant sites in the body. Even if they end up there, they can't do very much because they can only grow a certain number of times before they exhaust their proliferative potential, and then they stop growing, independent of where they ended up in the body. And I think I'm going to stop there since the time is late. And I have more to say, but enough for one evening. Let's go to questions now, because it's been an hour. And if you aren't tired by now, you deserve to be tired, having listened to all this. We're going to try Worcester first. Questions from Worcester.
Do we have questions? Someone have a question? We have one question back, yes.
I just wanted to know, is that the reason that bone marrow transplants don't necessarily always work because the proliferation of stem cells that are mutated already.
No, bone marrow transplantation is used as a therapy for certain kinds of cancers or leukemias. What one does is wipe out all the existing bone marrow, hopefully with getting rid of the cancer cells, and then put in a new bone marrow from somebody else, for example, with the hope that the new bone marrow will regenerate all the hematopoietic cells and one will have gotten rid of all of the pre-existing cancer cells when one got rid of the pre-existing bone marrow with contaminating cancer cells. The problem is that often when one does a bone marrow transplant and gets and tries to rid the body of the existing bone marrow and tries to rid the bone marrow of existing cancer cells, there are still some cancer cells left behind. And even though one successfully replaces the bone marrow, because there are some residual cancer cells that are not removed from the cancer patient, they can regenerate a new tumor and then you get clinical relapse. So it's not really connected intimately with bone marrow transplantation and stem cells. It is connected with the fact that in bone marrow transplantation, one normally does not succeed in ridding the body of all of the cancer cells that were present initially in the patient. Are those any other questions from Worcester?
You have a question? How about in the back? Yes, one more.
How do we know that the cells that we're calling cancer stem cells are stem cells and not just a regular cell that's become immortalized?
Well, we're getting now into semantics here. How do we know that the cancer stem cells are really cancer stem cells? Well, it's an operational definition. By that, I mean you take out some of these cells and you put them in a mouse and you get a cancer. And that means that this small number of cells that you've transplanted into a mouse can give you a tumor 1,000 or 100,000 or 1,000,000 times larger than the number of cells you initially implanted. So by that functional, by that operational criteria, they're behaving exactly like stem cells. They're behaving exactly like a bone marrow. The stem cells in the bone marrow would behave. In other words, if you took a small number of hematopoietic stem cells and put them into a mouse that had lacked its own bone marrow, you'd regenerate the entire blood-forming system in the mouse. So it's a very analogous definition. You can create an entire tissue, in this case a tumor, with a small number of self-renewing cells. If you want, you can call it something else. You don't have to call them cancer stem cells. You can call them nasty cells. I don't know. But the fact is, they behave exactly functionally like as if they were stem cells.
Do you have any specific markers?
Well, we have a rule here. There's two rules: no cell phones, and two, you have to talk into a microphone so the people in Worcester can hear you.
So do you have any specific markers to track the stem cells, even though they are dormant, and that we can use like antibody against the marker to kill the stem cells?
So the question is, can you actually have ways of detecting dormant stem cells? And the answer is not yet. First of all, there could be a very small number of dormant stem cells. Secondly, a lot of the markers on the surface of cancer stem cells are likely to be expressed by normal cells. And thirdly, how many cells do you think are present in the normal human body? I'm glad I asked that question, too. It's actually pretty large. There's roughly 3 × 10^13 cells in the normal human body. And let's say you have 100 or 1,000, 10^2 or 10^3 cancer stem cells hanging out here or there. It's a minute needle in a very large haystack. So our technology is not yet adequate to detect these small numbers of cancer stem cells. 3 × 10^13 is roughly 30,000 trillion cells. That is, as I often say, more than you can shake a stick at. It's quite a few.
When you described the five systems that have to get knocked out, it wasn't clear to me, first of all, if they have to go in a specific order or if it's just random and it's just when they accumulate all five. And do you think these cancer stem cells are stem cells that had, say, those five systems knocked out, or are they other kinds of cells that become cancer stem cells in some way?
Well, you're asking two very good questions, neither of which I can answer. In general, we don't know whether the order of knocking out the different subcircuits is fixed, or whether you can deregulate them in different orders in different tumors. In the case of colon cancer, the first change always is the same. I told you that was called APC. And that always happens first. But all the other changes, and there could be four, five, six, seven other ones that we, so far we don't know whether or not they have to come in any specific order. That's unknown. Secondly, there was a second question you asked to which I also didn't know the answer.
Are the cancer stem cells?
So where do the cancer stem cells come from? Well, the most parsimonious explanation is they come from normal stem cells that have acquired these four or five or six different deregulatory mutations. But we don't really know. So once again, I plead ignorance because this whole field, how old is this whole field? Maybe 3 years old. So what I'm telling you is not old hat. This is stuff which is hot off the presses, and we're still wrestling with the conceptual implications of these new discoveries about solid tumors. In truth, cancer stem cells were realized to exist in leukemias quite a few years ago. But everybody thought that was a peculiarity of leukemias, had no relationship at all to do with solid tumors like the breast cancers or the brain cancer I showed you this evening. But now we begin to realize that these cancer stem cells are likely to be operative in a wide variety of human tumors, maybe all of them. So this has really been a conceptual revolution for cancer research, and it has many implications. Among them, therapy. Because when, here's an interesting story, when somebody, a medical oncologist is treating a cancer, and they see that the cancer has, they've given some kind of chemotherapeutic drug and the cancer has shrunk by 70%, they'll say, gee, this is terrific. But what of all of the loss of the 70% is the loss not of cancer stem cells, but all the other cells that couldn't grow anyhow? This tumor shrunk as a whole, but the population of self-renewing stem cells was unaffected. Tumor's going to bounce right back. I showed you an example of that. So the drug companies are just coming to realize now that if they really want to cure cancers, they have to figure out ways of killing the cancer stem cells, not the other kinds of cells which don't have much ability to proliferate anymore or have no ability to proliferate anymore. And this has not begun to, the ripples of this have not yet been felt among those who are involved in trying to generate new ways of treating cancer. We don't really know how to detect cancer stem cells that well. So there's lots of fundamental, simple problems which are still very elusive.
So let's take one more, and then we'll retire down to the reception afterwards. Who's the lucky person?
Here I'm dealing with an oncologist.
Let's do two questions. One more from this side. We'll do them, and someone here gets a chance.
Okay. Well, I would like to make a comment and ask a question. One, it seems to me as though the use of the stem cells is very much the same. You're asking about an older phrase. What we've used for a long time is colony-forming units as being something which is equivalent to, I think, the modern stem cell. But the implication, if I followed you, is that if a tumor has grown up and then it has been treated and it comes back and you do this many times, you get progressively more stem cells. And so you should have a higher, is this correct, that you'd get a tumor which is increasing the number of stem cells with each time it's either transplanted or each time it recurs after, say, surgery?
It could be. It doesn't have to be. It could be.
Oh, it doesn't.
It doesn't have to be, no. I'm just saying that Malthusian growth, Darwinian selection, indicates that if you allow a population of tumor cancer stem cells and transient amplifying cells to grow long enough in a patient, if you gave it enough time, enough years and decades of time, eventually the whole population of cells would have an increasingly higher percentage of stem cells. So that maybe if you allowed it to go for 50 years, you'd have a population of pure stem cells, which would be a very nasty tumor. But of course it doesn't happen because the patient may have died 45 years earlier. So it becomes, in the immortal words of my mother, a mute point. Anyhow.
All right.
Yeah, this is just, I think, a simple question, but the model you gave where the stem cells go into the transient amplifying cells where there's limited division, and then finally when they're fully differentiated, there is no longer any division. Is that a model, or is that true for all of the differentiated types of cells in our bodies? Is it thought that that's the way that all types of cells in our body...
All kinds of normal cells in our
normal
body.
Normal cells, yes.
Normal cells. It's true for most kinds of normal cells, but not all kinds of normal cells. If I were to come, I wouldn't do this, but if I were to come up to you now and cut out two or three lobes of your liver, you're safe. The remaining differentiated cells in the liver would start multiplying until they regenerated a liver of normal size. And those cells, although they're fully differentiated, are not post-mitotic because you've mobilized them to divide again. On the other hand, the cells in your brain are almost all, and my brain, are sadly almost all post-mitotic. They cannot divide anymore. So it depends on the tissue. The end-stage keratinocytes in the skin, they're also post-mitotic, and they're falling off by the hundreds of millions every day when you take a shower. Most tissues, the highly differentiated cells, are post-mitotic, but not all tissues.
Thank you very much.